put back in the exceptions that were in the amendments that this committee passed on April 22, and then to accommodate Mr. Gallant's, I think, legitimate concern that this could be creating unintended liability for physicians or other people, we could put into the immunity clause that no person will be held liable, and this is not the exact language, no person will be held liable for a decision not to obtain informed consent. And, that sort of immunity would be standard in an emergency situation. I mean, in an emergency, you have to decide that you're going to do certain things without the person's consent, and there would be a certain degree of immunity for a physician making a decision under those sort of circumstances. And so I think you could immunize the person from liability so that they would not be responsible for having to make a correct determination about whether there was or was not a serious threat to a third person. And that would, I think, preserve the core notion of getting informed consent in the vast majority of instances. It would allow exceptions, but it wouldn't create any liability for a person's decision to act on the basis of one of those exceptions.
Mr. Chairman, I hate finding it to go back through circumstance that a number of us have debated and argued for hours and try to make a determination where I thought at least I had gotten to where I am today, and try to say that I'm going to possibly agree to that at this stage. But that aside, as a practical matter, physicians cannot do procedures without consent of individuals. We cannot provide surgery to an individual without their consent, or tests either. And you just can't. It's not practical. It cannot be done.
I think the committee is at least aware of the situation that we're in with this, and it'll be a policy decision that the committee makes, so rest easy at this point.
But
let's go on.
But I might add one other caveat to this, if I may, is that if the concern of Mr. Falk is to provide some kind of protection from liability for the conduction of a test, maybe it ought to be attached to 677097 that just says that any test conducted without informed consent due to an emergency, the physician will be protected from civil liability. I have a feeling, however, that the concerns of Ms. Remington and Mr. Fox and others would then, in fact, be placed out of balance, probably.
Okay. As I understand it, as a practical matter, at least up to this point, Christy, it's been your experience that the obtaining of the informed consent has not been a problem up to this point. Is that what I hear you saying?
In general, people have obtained informed consent. One of the reasons this was put in, I do have to take a slight exception with what Mr. Gallant has just said. Physicians do receive informed consent for sticking a needle in someone's arm and drawing out some blood. But in today's world, they often are somewhat less explicit about exactly what tests they're going to run once they get that specimen in their hands. And that's why we're trying to make this piece explicit. If you're going to run this particular test, we really think you ought to tell people up front. But in general, in those healthcare worker exposure situations, that was what triggered all of this, patients have been willing to consent to have the test done in order to give the information that people want to have. I think there have been a few that have not.
Excuse me?
I said I think we could find a few exceptions where the patient has just held tight and said, no, I don't want you to test it. But
okay, well, just one other question on that. When a person is taken, you know, and when we get to the corrections, perhaps this, a person sent over to the penitentiary, I assume that this would apply to them also, then. The medical staff at the penitentiary would not be able to test these individuals without informed consent?
That would be my understanding of it. I don't believe they're exempt from any of the existing informed consent requirements for the work they do on their patients over there.
The fact that they've, you know, these folks have given up their civil rights, this still would be applicable to them.
You need to ask someone else. I would not think they would be exempt from it, but someone else may know better than I.
Okay, when we get to the corrections.
Some of their civil rights, not all of them.
Yeah.
Right.
They can still smoke, can't they?
Not we have a way.
They don't have to buckle a seatbelt in the penitentiary either.
We're going to make them buckle up, too.
What's next?
Okay, is there additional testimony that you folks wanted to give on this?
Let me just close with one comment. This bill, it covers a lot of territory. What we started into, as I think I've pointed out earlier, was modernizing a statute that had been unread by anybody for many years, because when we got into a new disease, people started reading things and saying, gee, we should update it and clean it up. The principal driving forces of revising the basic statute are contained in the sections that were in the major original bill and the clarifications in these new amendments that deal with the due process. I respect the difficulties involved with dealing with all parts of it, but also this informed consent piece, which came in a little later and which you perhaps had less time to deal with. I would hope, if we cannot reach clarity on a way to handle the informed consent that's comfortable for all parties, that would not be allowed to pull down the entire bill, and that we could deal with the other parts of it, because I do think it is critical to get the due process pieces clarified and in place for the protection of people in a lot of circumstances, not just related to this epidemic.
Okay. Any questions for any of the witnesses? If not, thank you, and
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, could I just make one final comment? And that is, there is a letter which has been submitted to you, which is the Oregon State Bar's endorsement of this bill, which had not been done at the time of your previous action.
Let me ask you, if we take out Section 17, will there still be that endorsement?
Well, naturally, I can't say, and I'm just simply the messenger for that endorsement. The three premises for their endorsement were the reform of the quarantine provisions, the informed consent provision, and the confidentiality provision. Whether they'd be in favor of two out of three, I can't say.
Okay, Scott, before you go, I need to, would like to have a statement on the record. Because, you know, the committee is taking a look at this bill. It's an area that I at least feel very uncomfortable with dealing with, and have asked you as the representative of the Oregon Medical Association to look at this bill very carefully and to have your professional, your doctors, take a look at it and give me some indication as chair of this committee that they feel that this bill is a step in the right direction, that we are at least, you know, as far as this bill goes, doing the right thing. Now, could you respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe all of you have a copy of a memoranda from me to you, basically indicating just that. Looks like this, dated May 20th. Probably the last paragraph on the second page summarizes it best, stating that the final product encompasses an improved communicable disease statute in general, protects individuals against potential quarantine abuses, does not unduly hamper the abilities of public health officials to impose necessary measures, and guarantees that HIV antibody tests will not be administered in an insensitive and indiscriminate fashion, end quote.
And then, Christy, I'd like to make sure that I understand the Health Division's position and like to have that on the record. That, in other words, you know, I'll be real frank with you. I go back home to my constituents, they're going to ask me, well, what did you do with 2067? I want to be able to say that the legal profession, the medical profession, and the Health Division said this is the thing to do. That it wasn't a decision made by Rick Kotulski or members of his committee or even of the legislative body alone, that we had the best advice possible in doing this. And would you, you know, speak to that point?
I think the provisions of this bill are a very timely improvement in our public health approaches in this state. They balance the needs of individuals with the community's necessary need to protect itself. And I think it strikes a good balance in those occasionally apparently conflicting needs that lets public health workers proceed, but in general allows the practice of medicine to also proceed in a sensible way. And I think we will find in practice, if these are adopted, a good solid system that is effective in Oregon.
Thank you. Any questions or comments to these? Yes, Representative Van Leeuwen.
Following up on a question you asked a minute ago, Mr. Chairman, if Section 17 were just lifted out of here, would the Health Division have the authority to make a rule that covers this subject, or if you saw a need, would the Health Division make that rule?
Two comments in answer to that. First, I would hope if you're going to lift out part Section 17 that you would leave in Section 3 on disclosure of test results, because that's the confidentiality issue that is separate from the informed consent issue. So if we can't come to grips with the informed consent, I hope we leave in the confidentiality portion. I do not believe that my present rule-writing authority would allow me to write rules on informed consent that would be binding on Oregon practitioners, as I understand the authority.
Okay, I also understand, as I'm looking at 677-097, that at least for physicians, that Section 17, subsection 1, would be applicable whether it was written in this particular statute or not. And would that be
that
your understanding?
That is my understanding. That is my understanding.
So that taking 17 out would not accomplish, you know, what I think you're looking at. Okay.
Also, could I just say in answer to your question, the informed consent requirement would apply to a lot of organizations of which I don't think the Health Division probably has authority to regulate, such as insurance companies and insurance company testing organizations.
You have a second part of that sentence.
Basically, Mr. Chairman, that section says that other health care providers would basically go along the same sorts of informed consent as that section, and secondarily, that the Health Division would adopt by rule procedures for non-health care providers for the committee's clarification on the
section.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, we are in work session. We've got the medical profession, we've got the legal profession, and we have the Health Division indicating to us that this bill, as amended, is what they think is the best public policy.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carter.
Are you prepared for and accepting of the amendment?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Camden Gross version of 2067, the amendments be accepted.
Okay. Representative Carter moves the amendments to House Bill 2067, the Hammond Groves, May 20th, 1987 amendments. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ford.
I concur with the motion to accept the amendments. I know we've gone over and over it, and I see problems no matter what way we go. I think this is the best policy. I think it's the safest with the knowledge that we have of the situation today.
Okay. Representative Van Leeuwen, did you?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Without having the opportunity to do the research and to search these out a little bit further, since we just got these amendments after we came into committee today, I'm not comfortable with them. You're not comfortable with them. You've put on the record what these different people think, I'm just not comfortable in voting positively for them today until there's a chance to research them out a little bit further.
Representative Vanlin, I'd like to make my position clear. It's not that I am uncomfortable with the particular amendments that we have received today. I am uncomfortable with the level of our knowledge and how to deal with this particular disease. That's what I'm very uncomfortable with. I'm not uncomfortable with the amendments as have been explained. As you know, most of the bill we've already looked at, but the amendments that we've talked about, I've pushed as hard as I could on them for the express purpose of trying to find what that level of knowledge was. Now, I am confident from the testimony and the answers to the questions that to the best of their knowledge and to the best of the knowledge that's available to us as policymakers in the state of Oregon, this is the best thing to do. I am unsure, however, or uncomfortable that any of us in this country know what the hell we're doing with this disease.
Okay.
That's right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vanlin.
If, unless I'm misinterpreting what the new Section 17 does, unless I'm not understanding that section, only you're trying to point out just now, and I haven't had time to study it, that it's already in the ORS in a different fashion. What this says is that even though the physician strongly suspects that the person has AIDS, unless that patient gives him the consent, he can't even have a blood test run.
That's the way it is with every particular disease because of that statutory requirement on physicians. He can't test you for tuberculosis without informed consent.
But in another arena that gets into the human services, if we even suspect that a parent has been abusing a child, we can take the child out of the home. I mean,
there is no justice in this world, Representative Van Loon, except what we can make.
Where is it written?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shipwreck.
I share the chair's concern about this and also point out this. The first time this session I've ever said this, and I don't like to, but this, I point out, is a House bill. It was supposed to be out of here about a month ago.
Yeah.
We're going to shut this building down, and I was told committees are going to shut down June 1st. I think this is an important issue. And this is one of those rare exceptions where I'm as concerned as the whole committee is. But I would suggest we send the bill over to the Senate and see what else develops. Come back perhaps for concurrence. And I just don't see anything more we can do to this bill at this point here. And I think it is important that the bill not die, however. So for that reason, I'll support the motion.
Now that we've all given our eulogies for the bill.
Representative Vagrons, I knew you would have to.
Under those circumstances, I would move the previous question.
Okay, thank you, Representative Vagrons. That surprised the heck out of me.
You never know, do you?
Is there objection to the amendments? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carter.
I move House Bill 2067 to the floor with a duplass recommendation.
Representative Carter moves 2067 as amended to the floor with a duplass recommendation. Discussion. Hearing none, Carolyn, would you call the roll?
Representative
Abrams? Aye.
Representative Carter?
Aye.
Representative Ford?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Hamstad?
Aye.
Representative
Kibler? No.
Representative
Shipwreck? Aye.
Representative Van Loon?
No.
Chair
Kowalski? Aye. House Bill 2067 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have any volunteers that want to carry this bill again? Hate to assign it to anybody, but I'm not going to carry it. So it's going to get assigned to somebody.
I had the last one, Mr. Chairman.
I get helmets next week.
I voted no.
I wonder if that's why Representative Pickard voted no.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ford.
Good freshman, Bill.
Thank you, Representative Ford. I appreciate you taking on the responsibility of that. The rest of us have shown our cowardice. Now, I've asked the Corrections Division just to give us, to come in and give us a short...
Do I?
Yeah, short. Presentation on how the Corrections Division is dealing with this subject of AIDS and the Corrections Division. It was not directly related to this bill. However, I wanted the committee to at least be aware of what the Corrections Division is attempting to do. And with that, would you please take over? Kathy, please identify yourself for the record, too.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Knox. I'm the manager for the Health Services Programs for Corrections Division. This testimony has been prepared to provide you with information about the problem and management of AIDS in correctional systems and to describe what Oregon Corrections experience has been to date. It's a lengthy packet, but my testimony is only 3 pages and it's 10 minutes long. The rest are attachments that really provide you with some background and resource information. The first point is that as a point of reference, there are no prisoners at state-operated facilities that, as of today, are diagnosed with AIDS. There are several...
Well, there are people who are... If you let her finish, Representative Ford.
Okay. There are several inmates incarcerated at the state facilities who have tested positive for the AIDS antibody. And we have one inmate who has symptoms of underlying immune suppression that puts him at risk of opportunistic infection. Second, the Oregon Corrections Division has discussed and implemented policies to manage the AIDS crisis since the spring of 1985. At that time, a person with AIDS was admitted to Oregon State Hospital as a psychiatric patient. This required immediate substantive efforts to prepare staff to care for persons who are diagnosed with AIDS and who are admitted to state institutions. It was at that time that the Department of Human Resources established the AIDS Task Force to collaborate in the areas of problem solving, policy development, and resource sharing. I have served on this task force since its inception. Three, by the fall of 1985, healthcare staff with the division had been trained and procedures established for the diagnosis, care, and treatment of persons with AIDS. Also that fall, we began to include AIDS training in the orientation for new employees, and the first information education programs were conducted with current employees. Most recently, the last week in April, the division provided 5 4-hour training sessions on AIDS for 280 line staff from the institutions and a 2-day training session for 100 parole and probation officers. The training was provided free of charge to the state by a grant from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Four, in December of 85, the National Institute of Corrections and the Department of Justice sponsored a 2-day symposium on AIDS and correctional systems that was attended by myself, the administrator, and our legal counsel. The results of this conference and a survey, which was conducted in November of that year, established the first database within state, federal, and local correctional systems, both for the incidence of AIDS in prisons and jails, and for policy development as well. 5 key facts from this report are summarized in the handout titled AIDS in Prisons and Jails, which is Attachment A. At that time, again, it was 1985, half of the prison systems had no AIDS cases, and 80% of the systems had fewer than 4 cases. The majority of cases, however, over 70%, were in New York, New Jersey, and Florida. and they were associated with the high-risk activity of needle sharing and IV drug use. The jurisdictions within those states all had the same combination of policies, which are listed on page 6 of that attachment. They are medical segregation of AIDS patients, but no segregation of inmates who were infected with the virus but without symptoms, antibody positive, or those who had ARC, the AIDS-related condition. Secondly, careful evaluation and ongoing monitoring of inmates who were suspected of having ARC or AIDS. Thirdly, that there was no mass screening to the antibody for the virus. And lastly, that they had extensive staff and inmate educational programs. In January of 1986, the same combination of policies was adopted by the Oregon Corrections Division and is described in more detail on the second page of a briefing paper titled AIDS and its Impact on the Corrections Division, which is Attachment B. This was prepared for the governor. On number seven, the National Institute of Justice resurveyed correctional systems in the fall of 1986, so this was 1 year later. And a copy of this report is provided as attachment C. Summarized, the key results were that there was more conclusive evidence that AIDS was not spread through casual contact. The numbers of AIDS cases in correctional systems had increased, but at a rate slower than the increase in the population at large. Again, New York, New Jersey, and Florida have over 70% of the cases and continue with a policy of antibody testing for diagnostic purposes only or no testing at all. There are only four jurisdictions which had mass screening programs in 1985, and this number decreased to three in the 1986 survey. The risk factor of needle sharing in conjunction with IV drug use continues to account for the majority of AIDS cases in correctional systems. Finally, no cases of AIDS among correctional staff have been attributable to contact with inmates. One area of controversy has been the degree to which incarceration itself puts inmates at risk of exposure to AIDS. A study was done in Maryland in 1985 which tested 137 inmates for the AIDS antibody. These inmates had been continuously incarcerated for 7 years or more, so would have had to have become infected while incarcerated. There were only, of that 137, there were only two persons who had positive antibody tests, which was 1.5% of the sample tested. New York State, in 1986, analyzed all of their AIDS cases and found only five inmates with AIDS, or 2.3% of the total number of cases that they had, who had been continuously incarcerated from 5 to 7 years, and so would have had to have become infected while incarcerated. Again, because of the relatively small number of persons continuously incarcerated for this length of time, the study can only suggest rather than conclude that the risk of transmission during incarceration is low. The Centers for Disease Control is planning to sponsor similar studies in other correctional systems. As of today, the division is reexamining its policies in relation to the management of AIDS. The areas that are being considered are expansion of HIV testing from what is now our policy, testing only for diagnostic purposes, to testing high-risk individuals for whom knowledge of the test results would positively influence behavior change. The testing program would be voluntary with informed consent with pre and post-test counseling. We are working with the Alcohol and Drug Program Office to identify community-based groups which can provide more intensive education and behavior change interventions with high-risk inmate populations. This would include information on needle cleaning and safe sex. Potential resources have been contacted and include the local AIDS resource groups and HERO, which is a nonprofit group which has provided inmate education and counseling for the Maryland correctional system. We are considering a packet which would be provided to inmates at the time of release However, with recent cases of antibody infection in ARC who are under probation supervision, it appears use of the packet should consider all cases under supervision of Corrections Division and not just institution inmates. This packet would contain the information pamphlets on AIDS, needle sharing, and safe sex, a list of the alternative test sites, the names of community-based AIDS organizations, the names of the community outreach workers, and perhaps condoms with instructions for use. The packet would be given to offenders at the time they make contact with a supervising field officer. Lastly, we've ordered new and updated videotapes and training material for use with both offenders and staff. We've developed a 4-hour in-service curriculum to deal with major communicable diseases and a handbook on communicable disease, which has been written for non-medical staff. These in-service and education programs deal with risk reduction from a wellness standpoint applied to all of the major communicable diseases and not just AIDS, and the measures to prevent occupational exposure. Feedback from staff on the training program has been extremely positive. I've also included in the handout as Appendix D the most recent action plan for AIDS education to give you an idea of the scope and detail of our current efforts. This plan has already been implemented at OSP. I hope that this testimony has been informative. And
yes, it has. Yes. Thank you.